Thank you, Sue. And good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is February 25th, 2021. I am Louise Dovery Bjorkman. I'm joined on the panel today by Chief Judge Susan Siegel and Judge Edward Cleary. The next matter on our case for oral argument is the State of Minnesota versus Sean Mechtel. Counsel, while we are proceeding by Zoom, our procedures are basically the same. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your argument. The timing will be indicated in the square with the clock that you will see shortly. So be mindful of the time. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Christopher Mishick. I'm an assistant state public defender. I represent appellant Sean Mechtel. May it please the court. Again, I represent Mr. Mechtel. After pleading guilty to first degree criminal sexual conduct, Mr. Mechtel was sentenced to the top of the box for 187 months. He's now seeking to withdraw his guilty plea, alleging in a petition for post-conviction relief that his plea was unintelligent. The question before the court in this case is, has Mechtel alleged sufficient facts in his post-conviction petition about the intelligence of his plea to warrant an evidentiary hearing under Chapter 590? The answer is yes, he has. So I want to first start with the plea standard and the intelligence standard. For a plea to be intelligent, the guilty plea must represent a knowing, intelligent choice among the alternatives available. Whether a plea is intelligent depends on what the defendant at the time of the plea knew. Here, there is enough alleged in the petition concerning the misadvice of his trial attorney to warrant an evidentiary hearing and to create a fact issue about whether the plea was intelligent here. He was told on the record that this is a straight plea. However, he's going to be sentenced pursuant to the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. He was then told that the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, the presumptive range is in the neighborhood of 144 months.
Counsel, before we get to that, yep. The question that just sticks out in my mind, having read all of this, is why wasn't there language in the plea petition indicating a cap of 144 months? That had been the offer.
The offer had been 144 months, that's right. But the cap was under the guidelines.
No, I'm not talking about the guidelines. If the prosecution offers 144 months and the defendant wanted 108 and they said no, then why not just go back and enter a plea saying, all right, we'll cap it at what you want, 144 months.
Right, that didn't happen here. My understanding is the plea petition doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't say that. And instead the defense says they anticipated a downward duration of departure. Right. But it seems to me real basic for a defense attorney to limit the possible damage for his client and have a cap in there.
Right.
Is there anything in the record indicating that the state refused that?
Refused to have a cap of 144?
Yeah.
Well, no, I can't recall it. I don't think so, that there's anything in the record that states refusing that. But I think it would, the understanding though, was that going in, it was, between the attorneys, at least, what I'm surmising is that they thought it was between a guidelines 144 to 187 or a departure. But I think there's just some basic lawyering here that didn't happen. I mean, on the record, he could have told his client, this is 156 is the middle of the box. Here's the low end. Here's the high end. Do you understand that that's what we're getting into here? And that was never done. He was just told, well, it's 144. That's the presumptive. In the neighborhood. And more confusingly, the state then said, well, and it's also the judge may decide to not send you to prison. You may get a downward duration or downward dispositional departure. That was never on the table.
Let me ask you this. I mean, we have a well-developed body of case law in Minnesota that defines what makes a plea intelligent in terms of the consequences of the guilty plea. And what the case law suggests is we're looking at direct consequences, which include the maximum sentence and any fine to be imposed. As I understand the record, there is no dispute here that your client was told multiple times, and including in the plea petition he signed and including twice by the court on the record during the plea hearing, that the maximum sentence was 30 years and that there was a fine. Why isn't that case law and the fact that those requirements were met, why isn't that significant to conclusively establish that your client cannot recover?
Judge Bjorkman, I think that question is the crux of this case. And the answer is because he was affirmatively misadvised, because he was told the wrong number. So in Trott, for example, the case relied on by the state, it's in the fine details, but he was never told the presumptive range in Trott. This case is different from Trott. And that's because in Trott, he actually received a plea withdrawal hearing where he was allowed to testify, and then his former attorney was allowed to testify. Then the district court made findings about the credibility of what the defendant knew. That, again, that's never happened here because we haven't had a hearing.
As I understand it, he was advised, and I think it, again, is undisputed, he was advised a couple of times, when he was originally offered by the state 144 months, which I think was subsequently withdrawn by the state as an offer, but he was told that there could be a sentence that would not require a departure that could go up to the 187 months. I mean, didn't his lawyer tell him that a couple of times?
Well, his lawyer told him that, and I quote the quotes from the letter that his attorney wrote him in the petition. His lawyer told him that if he goes to trial, that he's exposing himself up to 187 months. But again, that's if he goes to trial. And I don't know if Mr. Mechtel is legally astute enough to know that, well, that range now applies to doing a straight plea.
The context of those letters were, again, that I think the lawyer recommending that he take the plea to the 144 months, right? And with the alternative being, it could be up to 187 months without it being a departure, correct?
Right. And he used the language, you know, you can limit your exposure by pleading guilty. And albeit it is pleading guilty to the state's offer, you can limit your exposure to 144. There's a lot in the record before he had a different attorney, Ms. Funk. And the 144 number is thrown out all the time as kind of what he was fighting against. He didn't really, he disagreed with his attorney previously and was not accepting 144 as the amount. So this number 144, I think, was going around a lot. And in that sense, I think he needed to be told, look, if we're going to go to sentencing and you're going to get a guideline sentence, it's really up to 187. You need to know that going in. And he just wasn't, there's nothing in the record but showing that. But I want to go back to your question, Judge Bjorkman. Bjorkman, again, Trott is a different case. My take is that a defendant does need to be advised correctly about the sentencing guidelines. I think Trott stands for the position that, if there is no, a district court doesn't need to affirmatively advise the person on the record to make the plea intelligent. But I think there's enough in this court's case law. And if you look at the unpublished cases of Martinez and I think it's Levkowich, there's a lot of discussion in those two unpublished cases about this distinguishing factor about whether something is affirmatively misadvised versus just not advising at all. So I think that's a key distinction here. I want to point the court back to the petition itself that we wrote. Paragraphs 12 through 16 in that petition, we've alleged that Mechtel was erroneously advised about the presumptive sentence, that he relied on his attorney's representations, and that he believed that going into sentencing, it was between a downward departure in 144. And that he didn't understand that by entering a straight plea, the court was free to sentence him up to 187. So I think with those few lines there, that's enough to hear warrant an evidentiary hearing about what he knew. And again, we're not asking this court to hold that that this was an intelligent, not unintelligent plea. We're asking the court to rule that there's enough here to raise a fact issue about what he knew and to allow Mr. Mechtel to testify on the stand about what his attorney told him, what he believed was happening. Perhaps his attorney will testify. The district court that could then make some credibility determinations. I think
just to be clear, as I read Kaiser, Alanis, and that case law, I mean, you're really, if I agree with you, and I'm not saying I don't, we would be changing the case law. We would be saying, we would be holding that a direct consequence for purposes of an intelligent guilty plea would be what is the presumptive guideline sentence, in addition to what the maximum sentence is and the fine that would be imposed, which is what the existing case law said. We would now be saying that a plea, a direct consequence is the guideline sentence as well. Is that, am I understanding what you're asking this court to do?
I think so, because I couldn't find any cases directly saying that. But I would caution you about direct versus collateral. I don't think it really matters what you label it, because of the fact that there has been an affirmative representation of, especially on the record, of saying this presumptive sentence is 144. Because in the unpublished case law, at least, as long as there's affirmative misrepresentation, it can be collateral as well. So I think it's more if you were to hold something and publish something under and it'd be new law, I think the holding would be that a plea isn't unintelligent when the defendant is given affirmative misrepresentation about the range or the middle of the box. And this is important, that the parties knew the criminal history score going forward, and when that representation happened, because in Trott, the Supreme Court was concerned about these scenarios, and this happens a lot. I think Judge Cleary, you'll know in Ramsey County, that the criminal history score isn't known by the parties, and they plead guilty anyways, and they go forward, and then it comes back with one number or the other. But in those cases, the defendant is usually warned a lot on the record and told, you know, here are the possibilities. You could have 1 point, you could go to this. If you could have 2 or 3 points and go to this. Or do you understand that? Do you still want to go forward? And there's a lot of that discussion on the record. So just kind of going back to what I was saying, I do think you may have to create a rule here that a plea would be unintelligent if a person is affirmatively misadvised about the sentencing range. And I think that rule makes sense because going back to more the broader language about a plea being an intelligent plea being a knowing and intelligent choice on the alternative courses of action, a defendant and his attorney and his defense attorney often rely on the guidelines and the grid. And if the defendant is given the wrong information, that calculation is off. They can't necessarily make the correct calculation about, you know, if I went to trial and lost, what would I get? If I pled guilty under the state's deal, or if I pled guilty under a straight plea, those numbers are very important, especially in this case where there's no talk of an aggravated sentence at all. And that's another point I want to make is, I don't think the rule here is that as long as he's advised of 30 years as the possible sentence, then it's intelligent, because 30 years was not even on the table. Anything close to 30 years wasn't on the table.
The point of intelligence in a sense, the defendant is protected from making a decision without knowing kind of the worst case sentencing scenario.
I agree. Yeah, the defendant needs to be protected from the worst case. But when there's no departure motion and there's really no talk of anyone going above the guidelines, I think it's reasonable to tell a client, look, your top exposure here is 187. You know, there's no talk here of going above that. That's what the guidelines say. And we can have a reasonable expectation here that the worst case really here is 187, even though there's the statutory maximum. So I see my time is up. I'm going to stop there.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Mishek. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherburne County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the appellant's reasons for relief are legally insufficient, so there was no abuse of discretion in denying the petition without a hearing.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. I know it's early on here, but I have a number of questions here. I mean, the issue, as we're told, is whether or not this goes to the evidentiary hearing. We're not making the decision about the intelligence of the plea. And I understand, as Judge Bjorkman has made clear, and she's right, that direct consequences are the standard we should be looking at. But when I look at this, at the hearing in July of 2019, for lack of a better word, it looks like a bushwhacking to me. The lawyer and his client are in court. There's no language. Up to that point, all they've talked about is 144 months. 108 been declined by the state. My first question is it clear the 144 had been withdrawn?
Your Honor, the 144 months was an offer for an agreed sentence. So he would have to agree to that sentence if he wanted to get the benefit of that offer. And he was advised to take that offer by his attorney.
Okay, let me finish then. So the state would not have agreed to 144 cap?
The offer was an agreed 144 months.
Okay, so he enters his plea having been told, as Judge Bretton points out, by the judge that there's a maximum penalty of 30 years and a minimum sentence of 144 months. Now his defense attorney puts in the petition defendants anticipates, which is an unusual word to use, a downward durational departure, which is misleading to a client, it seems to me, when you say it anticipates. The normal language is to say you're going to argue for that, not that you anticipate it. And then to make things more confusing, the state suggests the possibility of a dispositional departure in a probationary sense, saying we don't know at this point if the judge will send you to prison or not. So on the one hand, we have a judge indicating the direct consequences. And the other, everything that's happening in this courtroom seemed to be confusing for a defendant who's being told neighborhood of 444 months, anticipated a durational departure, and now we're even considering a dispositional departure. Your response?
Well, Your Honor, starting first with the prosecutor's statements, it's not clear from the record if she had seen a copy of the plea petition, and it wasn't clear through the record if there was going to be a request for a dispositional departure in addition to a durational departure. That hadn't been addressed by defense counsel, so I think that she was just covering those bases. And it's highly unlikely, but it's also possible to receive a durational departure that gets to a gross misdemeanor. So I don't think that there was any real confusion to be that was contributed there. Additionally, defense counsel had spoken with his client about the possible range of 144 to 187 and advised his client that if he wanted to limit his exposure to the 144 months, he needed to accept the state's offer. Implicit in that is if you don't accept that offer, you're opening yourself up to the range of 144 to 187.
Well, excuse me for interrupting, but you say implicit in that. It's got to be more than implicit. It's got to be explicit. Somebody's got to be telling him that. Much of what you've said in response to my question is kind of an inside game for the attorneys and the judge to know. But what does the defendant know, and what's he being told?
Your Honor, the defendant was told exactly what he needed to be told under the case law about an intelligent plea. He was advised of the mandatory minimum of 144 months and the statutory maximum of 30 years. He'd also been advised that the range, the non-departure sentencing range for this offense was 144 months to 187 months. So yes, he had.
But that statement is made in the context of if you go to trial and are convicted. I mean, that's not what happened here. So why would he be expecting 187 months based on those prior communications?
Well, part of that same dialogue was about getting the benefit of the state's plea offer and limiting that exposure. He declined to do that, so he opened himself up to the sentencing range that he'd been advised of.
Isn't this presumptive sentencing range a direct consequence of a guilty plea?
Not under the case law that's out there, Your Honor. It's defined as the definite, immediate, and automatic part of the sentence. The sentencing guidelines, the specific range and the number aren't definite, immediate, and automatic because there is discretion for what the district court is going to impose at the sentencing hearing. And there's also some flexibility because of the specific number, the criminal history score that can change between a plea hearing and a sentencing hearing. So creating a rule where you have to be correctly advised about the criminal, about your exposure under the sentencing guidelines creates a process where a lot of pleas are going to be susceptible to a challenge because of intervening events. And I think that that's why the Minnesota Supreme Court hasn't adopted a rule where the sentencing guideline range is a direct consequence. And I believe in an unpublished case, this court has said being incorrectly advised of the sentencing guideline range does not make a plea unintelligent. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
So as I said, he's been advised of the direct consequences. The allegations that are here focus on the sentencing guidelines range, which is not a direct consequence. So in terms of that intelligence prong, those allegations are irrelevant. And there was no promise of a specific outcome here because he entered a straight plea.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but I having listened to what you just said a minute ago, we're suggesting, and you're suggesting, I think, that being told the statutory maximum is a proper, it's a proper way to get to a direct consequence and explain to the defendant when almost no one gets a statutory maximum. Why wouldn't it be that the presumed guidelines range, and 9 out of 10 times, that's going to be much more relevant. And that would be the direct consequence.
I think that, again, that goes back to what the direct consequence of a plea includes. And again, that's the direct, immediate, and automatic part of the sentence. Because of the calculations that have to go into that sentencing guideline range, I don't think that it meets that definite, immediate, and automatic definition, because there is some fluidity and flexibility between when the plea is entered and when the sentence is imposed.
Well, except that the statutory maximum is not going to, what's the relevance of that when it's never imposed?
But it is the maximum possible exposure here. So it's an immediate and automatic possibility, just like the mandatory minimum. So instead of taking the assured outcome of 144 months, appellant decided to enter a straight plea without any agreement, understanding that his sentence was going to be based entirely upon the sentencing guidelines and the court's discretion, including his request for a durational departure. He'd been advised that if he wanted the benefit of the 144 months, he needed to accept the state's offer. It was not a cap. So the plea transcript makes it very clear that he knew there was no agreement and there were no assurances of a specific outcome. So that too, based on the record before the court and the allegations in the petition, his plea was not unintelligent.
Well, counsel, just to take issue with that for a minute, what is the defendant supposed to conclude by language that the defense anticipates a downward durational departure?
I think that it fits more with a dispositional departure, particularly when there's going to be some actions that the defendant needs to take between the plea and sentencing to demonstrate particular amenability to probation. It's unusual in this context where it's going to be an argument that the offense was significantly less severe than the typical criminal sexual conduct charge. But I have seen situations where someone has anticipated pursuing a dispositional departure, but because of events that occur between the plea and sentencing, that is waived.
You just said anticipating pursuing. This doesn't say pursuing. This says the defense anticipates a downward durational departure. The defendant's being told that his counsel anticipates that it's going to be less, and it'll be a departure downward.
But if we look at the transcript from the plea, it's very clear that Mr. Mechtel knew it was entirely up to the judge, and that there was no promise of something less than the sentencing guideline range. It was entirely up to the court's discretion based on the sentencing guidelines.
Agreed. But would you agree that that petition is misleading to the defendant, saying that we anticipate a departure?
I don't know if I'd say it's misleading. I think it could have been worded better.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no more questions, I'm asking you to affirm the district court's decision.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. So thank you, counsel. And Mr. Mishek, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thanks, Your Honor. I don't have much to say. I just want to I want to go back though to the if this court does fashion a new rule, I think absolutely defendants need to be told the right thing when they're told things. So you know there is trot, and the court would have to deal with the law and trot that a plea isn't necessarily unintelligent if the defendant's not advised. However, again, when a defendant is told something by his attorney, the defendant should be able to rely on that and make an informed choice based on that. And
is that true even when you have the court making it very clear that there is a different potential consequence? I mean, I think because of how this plea went in fact, the court said that twice because they originally had the plea to count one and then it was changed to count two. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and this wasn't perfect advice given, and the neighborhood of 144 between lawyers and courts, that's has a different meaning probably than it does to a defendant looking at 144 versus 187.
I think under the facts of this case, I don't think it, again, matters that much that the statutory max was told to him. And because it just wasn't on the table, and because everyone knew that Mr. Mechtel only had one criminal history point from the offense, his last offense was the same victim. It was a solicitation conviction that he also pleaded guilty to. So there wasn't a question here of, well, Mr. Mechtel, we don't know where your score is going to come back after the PSI. So, you know, going into sentencing, you could have this larger range. So I think that should be taken into account, that the parties under these facts knew his score. And I think, you know, going back to the state's rule about direct consequences and it flowing automatically, I think the sentencing range that he dropped into did flow automatically from the guilty plea because his score was known. There was no discretion here. He was going to plop into that one box because he had 1 point. So that is a direct automatic consequences of his guilty plea. And because of that, he needed to know the correct number if he's going to be told a range. So if there aren't any questions, I'm going to leave it there.
All right. I don't see any more.
I'd ask this court to reverse and send it back to the district court for an evidentiary hearing so Mr. Mechtel can be heard on his claims.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. Your arguments were well done today. We appreciate the way you've presented the issues to the court. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. And that, I believe, is our last case scheduled for oral argument. So we will, I guess, recess and go to confer on the remaining cases. So thank you both, counsel.
Thank you.